Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I apologize for not having an Orthodox Nationalist last week. This has not been my year. I was sick fairly severely for a short period of time. And I'm not planning on that happening again anytime soon. As always, I request your support to keep this going, keep me functional, and to keep me independent. My website is rushjournal.org, rusjournal.org, and you can send me a few shekels through PayPal right there on my site, and there you have everything there that I've done, or at least pointing to everything that I've done. Since the publication of my USSR book last month, I've published something else something that I've had on this show before, the military leaders of Latin America during the Cold War. I spent two broadcasts on that particular topic, and a lot of that and a lot of extra material I put together in a book, and I have published it on Ramada Press. And speaking of which, today we're going to talk about something that used to be in the news almost every single day, and that is the crisis and the violence in Sudan. What that has to do with anything, what that has to do with us, what that has to do with the New World Order, and what that has to do with the Middle East and world order in general. Now, you know the principles that I've dealt with really since college, and I've really brought to a high level of detail, that there's two general forms of government, very general forms of government, monarchy and republican democracy. They're opposites. Even more broadly, you could call them traditionalism on the one hand, modernism, liberalism on the other hand. Monarchy radiates authority from a center point and acts as a locus of unity for the country, whether it be a city, a nation, or an empire, whatever the polity happens to be. He forces the elites to support the common good and only then to pursue their own good. So law is natural. It's discovered rather than made. The monarchy, again, this includes military leaders, civilian authoritarians, traditional monarchs. It's very masculine, symbolically speaking. It's symbolized by the sun, the number 1, 3, and 7, sometimes 9. It's usually the land-based power in the Eurasianist way of thinking, and sees commerce as a necessary evil, not a positively good thing. Now, the republic, republican democracy, whatever you want to call it, is based on the idea that there is no such thing as a common good. The central authority has been overthrown, and local elites, strongmen, create a constitution that justifies them getting together a few times a year and dividing up the country among them. They care only about their own good, and they pass laws that justify this. There is no real natural law in this system, generally speaking. They serve their interests exclusively. And symbolically speaking, it's very female. It's based on the numbers 2, 5, and 6. It's centered on the moon. It's often a sea-based power and dedicated entirely to commerce. Almost always, the trickster gods are its patrons. While for royal systems of all types, it's a figure, either Yahweh or a chief ruling god, like a Zeus or someone like that. Today we're going to deal with one of these monarchs, so-called, someone who typified this, someone along the lines of a Francisco Franco, a Cossack hetman, a Russian czar, anything like that. And it is General Omar al-Bashir of Sudan, who was overthrown back in April. Sudan is one of these countries that is a creation of colonial authority that created a country called Sudan, the largest in all of Africa. That's really, at a minimum, two nations, the Arabic and Islamic one in the north and the more black African one in the south. Now, back in the 1960s, African countries, with the exception of Ethiopia and Liberia, which were never colonies, began achieving independence at a very rapid clip. The Organization of African Unity, which was founded to try to make sense out of all this, made the decision that the older colonial borders are going to be maintained, because to try to devolve this to local authorities, whether it be tribal authorities, whatever, would cause far more bloodshed than just maintaining what's already there. And there's some justification to that. But these African states, generally speaking, aren't nations in any sense of the term. They're not even civil nations. But keep something in mind when you talk about African colonialism. The scramble for Africa in the 1880s was really the imposition of European colonial rule on the country. Not that I support colonialism in any way, but it was probably a much better situation than the patchwork of empires that had existed in Africa up until that point. The most significant were the Kingdom of Aksum, the Mali Empire, the Dervish State, the Asante Union, the Moravi Empire, the Benin Empire, Kanem-Bornu, and a whole bunch of others. These were fairly primitive slaveholding empires that often received much of their technology and weaponry from Islamic governments elsewhere. In many cases, when these more modern empires began to totter, European governments came in and created a more stable situation, for better or for worse. Now, the point of me saying this is to have you understand that Africa would be in this position even if a European never stepped foot on the continent. They were all slaveholding empires, and they all were imperial entities that treated tribal boundaries probably worse than the Europeans that came later. General Bashir is one of the good guys. Like so many other of these authoritarian leaders, he has been the subject of a lot of contempt from the regime, from the globalists, from especially oil companies. He's the, up until April, of course, when he was overthrown by his own military, he was the longest serving leader in all of Africa, 30 years. He's an Arab, generally speaking. I mean, he's part of the tribal culture there too, but he speaks Arabic. And he ruled Africa's largest country and potentially, along with Nigeria and South Africa, potentially Africa's wealthiest country. Back in 2009, the NATO-backed International Criminal Court tried to arrest al-Bashir, who was born in 1944, for war crimes in Sudan. And remember, they withdrew this for lack of evidence. And they tried again in 2010, then claiming that he was an indirect participant for the crimes in the southern part of Sudan. And the western part of southern Sudan is Darfur, which, as you know, was an elite obsession for a very long time. But even his enemies can't find evidence against him. The ICC's indictment has been imposed by the African Union, the League of Arab States, and the 9/11 movement. So it's not a popular thing. General Bashir is a career Sudanese military officer, 7th president of Sudan since independence. He's legitimately promoted army general. I mean, he's not one of these guys like you know, Mussolini that, you know, pins stars on himself. He's a combat veteran. But even the UN struggles with him because they will not label him as a terrorist. Russia and China are opposed to his being turned over to the ICC. They reject the ICC in general. And that now is really the crux of the matter. Russia and China, near the end of his reign, have invested heavily in the not only the oil wealth of Sudan, but the mineral wealth of Sudan. I mean, Sudan potentially can be one of the richest countries in the world. But in bringing in the Russians and the Chinese, we knew that eventually he would have to go. 30 years ago, he overthrew the failed government of Sadiq al-Mahdi, who wanted to end the war with the southern part of the country. The civil war has been going on for some time. But Mahdi helped destroy the economy, and he devalued the Sudanese pound to roughly 10% of its 1979 value. Like so many of these military men, General Bashir has overseen general prosperity, you know, relative to Africa. He's achieved high rates of economic growth, even in the face of a civil war in the south, sanctions and everything else. The 30-year rule of Bashir, the average GDP growth rate was about 8%, according to the IMF, which is impressive, you know, in third world standards. Of course, GDP is a very broad measure, but all the other measures are equally attractive. He brought inflation down. When he took over, inflation was about 50% a year. It rose right after the coup, but then drastically fell to maybe about 2% by 1998. The West supported the rebels in the southern part of Sudan because these rebels had promised to hand over the oil fields to the highest bidder, which of course would have been the US and the UK. So there was a massive propaganda war against Bashir in the so-called Darfur and all this emotional nonsense over the last decade in southern Sudan. And it's one of these things, it's an obscure part of the world, again, where the media could say whatever it wants. Now, there's another aspect to Johnson's Law, Johnson's Law 2, which is, or the second Johnson's Law, that states that when the press or governments or even semi-official agencies like Amnesty International or whatever are given a very obscure part of the world a lot of attention, an excessive amount of attention relative to its obscurity, then most of what's being said about it is false. And there's almost always, probably always, an economic element to it. So this is not a corollary to Johnson's Law. This is a separate law. But they both have to do with obscurity. Few people can point to South Sudan on a map. So why did so many multimillion dollar agencies suddenly obsess about this for so long? You know, the last 10 or 15 years or so. It may be obscure to most people, but it's not obscure to elites. But why? In this case, it's about oil, of course, and China's petrochemical corporation, PetroChina, having a great interest in the area. China began moving into Sudan and sponsoring some oil extraction. It's a huge oil, or at least potentially a huge oil producer. And then Russia was invited by Bashir to build a naval base there. This exclusively explains April's coup against him and shows that the CIA is behind it. The problem with Sudan is most of the oil is found in the southern part of the country. This is why the civil war was so bloody, and this is why the West was so absolutely obsessed with all this Darfur nonsense. Bashir was not a tyrant. Most of these military men were not. They didn't have the reach for that. They didn't have the resources for that. But Sadiq al-Mahdi, the man that Bashir overthrew, was permitted to come back into the country and freely organize opposition parties. He even ran for president. You know, some tyrant where his old enemy is allowed to come and form opposition parties. But you notice these patterns emerging where those who want to give the oil fields over to the West are usually Western educated. Sadiq al-Mahdi is no exception. He almost identified himself with the West, and he supported their interests. When Bashir took over in 1989, he inherited this civil war in the southern part of the country. His government was a federal one. It was only had limited powers that were granted to the central state. Sudan was not a dictatorship in the traditional sense. It was a fairly decentralized state. And its president, which was Bashir, can't necessarily be held responsible for the actions of local governors elected elsewhere. Now, in a civil war that the West created against all odds, harsh measures are not only necessary, but given Sudan's history, the only measures that would earn him the respect from his enemies, not to mention his own supporters. You remember the culture here, and this is a case in most of the world. that harsh reprisals and a firm hand isn't just necessary from a military point of view, but it's how you gain respect from your enemies as well as your supporters. The two main rebel groups in the South are the Sudanese Liberation Army and the Justice and Equality Movement. Now, the latter seems to be a very suspicious name because it's such a Western turn of phrase. They might as well have called it the Diversity and Inclusion Movement. It sounds like a group that a bunch of Ivy League professors had come up with. As is always the case, these are not popular movements. These are Western finance movements. Richard Kurt writes, he's writing in the Center for Research on Globalization, which I know many of my friends know about and respect very much. He says this, beginning in 2003, these two groups attacked and destroyed 80 or so police stations, killing upwards of 700 policemen. They attacked government garrisons, killed civilians. They also attacked a number of different key developmental, educational, and infrastructural projects that murdered a number of engineers working there. They attacked even a school examination center, stealing the national examination papers and affecting the lives of tens of thousands of school students. I guess they were giving the answers to people. I don't know. Later in the conflict, they can be seen attacking oil development projects and kidnapping and even killing Chinese citizens working there, demanding the Chinese oil companies be replaced by Western companies. The rebels can be found again and again expressing hostility towards China, accusing them of supporting the genocidal Sudanese government. Yes, I mean, the rebel groups actually have as one of their demands that Western oil companies be brought in to replace the Chinese. Now, if that doesn't prove sponsorship, then nothing can. Destroying government clean water stations isn't something that a popular group would ever do. It strongly suggests that these are mercenaries, that they're foreign-backed, because any real rebel group would never do anything like that. It's only because they have foreign backing, and many of them are from Uganda anyway. The creation of foreign states. Real groups like this will do everything they can to make themselves popular. They're not going to go blowing up examination centers and schools and infrastructural projects. And this is extremely strong evidence that the West has sent mercenaries in there to cause as much trouble as possible. Well, the result of all this is that the Republic of South Sudan was created by the U.S. in 2011 and immediately became an absolute miserable failure. The West oversaw a referendum for independence, which, by the way, came up with 99% in favor of it. And no one batted an eye at this. It's actually pretty surprising they'd even get more than 50%, since Bashir's very successful economic policies made him pretty popular, even in the South. So that means even in South Sudan, in 2012, the southern state lost about half its GDP. Inflation was around 200% a month. It's a failed state in every conceivable way. And of course, all the oil went to Western companies. And what little wealth they were able to create was sent to the West. Now, the first organized protest against General Bashir came in 2004. That's really when the Darfur Emergency Summit began. It was organized at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and the American Jewish World Service at the City University of New York Graduate Center in Manhattan. Now, for some reason, Elie Wiesel was the main speaker at this founding of this Darfur thing, and this is where the Save Darfur movement originated. I don't know how Elie Wiesel became an expert on Sudan, what he had to do with anything, but they also created this thing called the Jawanid Militia that's apparently supported by the North and has been at war with rebel groups in the South for years. Janjaweed means devils on horseback. Now, they don't call themselves that. That's what the rebels call themselves. And Kurt himself makes the point that it sounds evil. The name sounds evil. So this is the name that the press used for them. I've said this many times before, the ISIS propaganda. ISIS is a Hollywood bad guy name. There even is a bad guy name. I think it's Archer, where ISIS is the main bad guy. I've heard it many times before. It has two S sounds in it, so that reminds the hearer of a snake. In Hollywood, bad guy names usually have a lot of strong K sounds, because it's harsh, like a chopping, and S sounds, because it has that snake element to it. So having an enemy group sound evil is essential in building popular support. Janjaweed being demons on horseback is pretty blatant in this sense. The fact that Western writers refer to it as if that's their real name. But the Russia connection, as always, has brought the CIA to overthrow Bashir. As I mentioned, he invited the Russian military into Sudan for the same reason that Assad did in Syria. He stated what everyone knew, that the U.S. was fomenting rebellion in the south and needed Russian help, just like Assad did. Importantly, it would have been Russia's key to Africa, and this is the essential concept. Sudan is very strategic. Not only its oil and mineral wealth, it's located at the very intersection of North and East Africa. Its maritime placement is perfect. It's right on the western shores of the Red Sea and right on the western part of China's New Silk Road. Now, the plan was for China and Russia, but China specifically, to build the Trans-Saharan Railway from Sudan's port cities to Chad in order to rebuild the infrastructure needed for greater levels of trade with China and elsewhere. They were building up the oil industry to have another reliable source of supply. They were about to build a first world country there. In 2015, a Russian company discovered large deposits of gold in Sudan. All of a sudden, everyone's talking about Darfur. At the Olympiad in Sochi, Bashir was there and he granted Russian mining firms rights to these new mines that were recently discovered. The company is M Invest. This is in 2017. Sudan's Ministry of Minerals signed a contract with them, which is a Russian firm. M Invest is based in Petersburg. Right after that, Sudan bought a whole bunch of the fourth generation Su-24 Russian fighters and many equipment upgrades for its army. Again, it was selling a lot of oil. Now they have gold. They got the money. The deal was worth $1 billion. The U.S. had pressured the country of Djibouti, also extremely strategic, from building a naval base there. The Chinese always already had one there. Djibouti is one of these countries that is extremely strategic. The fact that no one ever talks about them is suspicious. There's both an American naval base there and a Chinese base there. A Russian base would have tilted the balance. Now, 1 year after the war in Syria began, once his war began in earnest with the Western-backed militias of southern Sudan, Bashir visited Syria. It wasn't that long ago, really, after Assad had essentially won the war against American mercenaries, and they both agreed that really the same people who were creating the civil war and really an international war in Syria were the same people, almost literally the same people, who were fighting in the war in Darfur, which is the western part of southern Sudan. So this is a globalized organization. They are mercenaries that go from place to place. Bashir said that the West was trying to balkanize the country into what amounts to five small states who wouldn't be strong enough to resist anything, and then hand over the oil and gold to the Americans. The five-state solution was the CIA solution to the war that they themselves created. And Russia, of course, made it very clear that the war, the protests, the violence, this comes from the West. Korbakov, Andrew Korbakov, is a great writer, a Russian scholar in international affairs, and he says this in the same Center for Research and Globalization. Altogether, the destabilization of Sudan could undermine China's Silk Road connectivity plans for Africa, as well as spilling over into neighboring countries, the Central African Republic, South Sudan, Ethiopia, all of which are struggling with various degrees of unrest as it is. Russia and Turkey's strategic interests in the Red Sea region and their Sudanese gateway into the Sahel could also be jeopardized, as could the foothold that Qatar is trying to establish on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula if Bashir is overthrown. While the GCC, which is the Gulf Cooperation Council, might lose a valuable military ally in the war in Yemen, Sudan's collapse conceivably be to their benefit if it spoils Turkey's and Qatar's plans. And of course, he should have mentioned Russia and China's plans too. In other words, he's stating that the coalition seems to be Qatar, Turkey, Russia, China, Syria, needless to say, and Armenia and Iran a bit further away. So this is why the U.S. was involved in intervention. This is why the extremely obscure region of Darfur, South Sudan, etc., became almost an obsession of American elites. You know, when they start having rock concerts for these places, you know something more is going on. When you have Bono over there, you know something more is going on. The popular protests, again, very suspicious. Can these people not figure out that Sudan's economic woes come from, not from its own creation, but from foreign interference? The script that Bashir was involved in, genocide, it's all the same script. It's the same deal. Now, the Western backing for this new junta that's taken over since April is foggy. They still might maintain ties with Russia. Even South Sudan, the creation of the U.S., is still maintaining ties with Russia. As we mentioned before, the Iraqi government, which was completely installed and created by the U.S., the constitution was written by the U.S., has voted to kick the Americans out, which made me laugh and, of course, humiliated the U.S. that lost so much money and even lives over there for this. But the thing that any popular protest can't figure out, that sanctions and civil war and everything is a cause of the economic problems, not the government, then they would have to be almost retarded. But of course they can. They can figure this out. And that's, again, more evidence that this comes from Western organization, not from anything local. Not to mention, many in the North are vehemently opposed to the creation of South Sudan. And anyone who knows anything knows that the West created this. But not too long before Bashir's overthrown, trying to put his economy back together again, Sudan secured loans, roughly $300 million. And it came not from the IMF, but it came from the UAE-based Arab Monetary Fund and the Arab Trade Financing Program. Qatar released a full support for the Sudanese government in late January. And frankly, he had the support of the entire Arab world, with obviously the obvious exception of Saudi Arabia. But what makes the whole thing very ironic is that Bashir was stepping down as president anyway. Apparently not fast enough for BP or Shell. The problem they had is that his Congress party still would have done very well in the elections. So Bashir himself stated this. He said, "We're not concerned with the ICC except for one thing. The methods that the court followed has a dangerous impact on signaling a message to the armed rebel groups that they should not reach peace with the government because its president is wanted by international justice, which would definitely lead to the government's fall, and therefore there is no need to talk to the government, which is perceived to have the international community against it. This is the most dangerous thing with this court." And of course, his prediction came true in every respect. And he goes on to say that this is the African position today. The ICC is a tool to terrorize countries that the West thinks are disobedient. By consensus, it is not to cooperate with this court in Africa, and it has reached a conviction that this court is directed against the countries of the Third World as a tool for neocolonialism. In other words, General Bashir, saying these words, is well aware, knows our position very well, and is stating that of, you know, the Third World National Socialism, which was extremely common, especially in military governments. And this is why, now that he's been overthrown, but he has not been turned over, by the way, he'll be dead before he stands before any court. Now, if you remember when Julian Assange was kicked out of the Ecuadorian embassy, within a couple of days, Ecuador received a $3 billion loan from the IMF. I'm hoping, but this isn't the case here, that the military government that overthrew Bashir is now speaking with the IMF for a huge loan to bail out the economy, only if they turn in Bashir. If they do, he'll end up like Milosevic or Hussein or Gaddafi. They're not going to allow any of these guys to testify in public against what the West has done to their countries. They did this with Milosevic briefly. He completely defeated the judges and lawyers in debate. They turned the mics off on him and eventually killed him. Ever since that happened with Milosevic, no one of any significance, like Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein, has ever been able to make his case to the court. They're always killed first. But using money and murder this way is certainly far more tyrannical than Bashir has even been accused of. Under his rule, he permitted Southern courts total independence. The Constitution that he wrote was very opposite of tyranny. It was federalized, decentralized, and even fairly radical separatists were satisfied with this. There was no reason to reject his system unless independence was never the issue. The fact that this was ignored proves that these protests were Western-controlled root and branch. So the primary issues dominating Western thinking here was the close role of China and Russia from the 1990s on in the oil industry, and making matters even worse, Sudan and Iran developed very close ties, and they are involved in backing, with increasing amounts of money, Palestinian groups in the occupied territories. Again, with Sudan's potential wealth, under a guy like Bashir, who's already been successful in this respect, he had to go. He was an embarrassment to the West because he was a successful leader who rejected the Western development model. These military men, these authoritarian rulers, when they reject the IMF, their countries do very well. His country was doing very well up until the West took the southern part of the country from him, and 75% of the oil wells, which were all in the south. The fact that he was there for 30 years meant that he had a long-term plan that he could develop over a long period of time. Once the war in the south was ended, a few years ago, the economy was taking off again. See, instead of what the IMF will do is come into a country and demand a reduction in state spending and a creation of an export-oriented economy, especially of raw materials. They certainly don't want no manufacturing, because the West has more manufacturing than, even if it's outsourced, it's foreign-owned manufacturing. And Western populations could barely buy all that. Overproduction is so overwhelming. These countries know this. And Sudan concentrated on building up basic infrastructure, transport, energy, water, as a basic foundation, a precondition for industrialization. But only a state-run economy can do that. Private economies will simply turn the country into a plaything of oil companies or and banks. In 2008, Murat Wesbach, writing for the Center for Research and Globalization, said, 1990s, Sudan's attempt to develop were hamstrung by financial constraints, exacerbated by pressures from the IMF to exact payment on debts contracted prior to the accession of power in 1989 of the government of General Bashir. The IMF demanded exorbitant monthly payments on debt, which it calculated in 1993 to be $1.4 billion. After initially refusing to pay, Sudan began to pay off about $35 million a year, and it took a tremendous toll on the economy. At the same time, the country launched an a national development effort, which worked, and Sudan began to pump, refine, and sell its oil. And since then, these increasing oil revenues provided the means for targeted investment in big infrastructure projects. The stress is on big. Over the last 7 years, several giant projects have been started that are transforming the nation. If Sudan is allowed to continue its current course, it could positively impact the entire region and set an example for development throughout the continent. This was said by Murat Wesbach in 2008. As I've said many times, the greatest sin of the West is that the countries that they've invaded and destroyed over the last 20 years have all been countries on the verge of first world status. Sudan was exploding with development. Bashir was incredibly successful. But remember, this is 2008. You cannot, Israel cannot be surrounded, Saudi Arabia can't be surrounded by wealthy, powerful, successful, popular governments. That'd be Russia, Iran, now Turkey, Sudan, Libya, Syria, Iraq. It couldn't happen. And so these countries that had, strained every nerve, mobilized every little resource to develop rapidly, searching for first world status, and almost achieved it, they had to be driven back to the Stone Age. to satisfy the demands of Western capital. That's the great sin. That's real genocide. Now you have starvation in Sudan, where you had, you know, a powerful and growing economy, an industrializing economy. It would have been the only real successful post-colonial economy in all of Africa. Excluding South Africa, of course, but they're a different story. They were sabotaged by the IMF. And then when Bashir went to Arab governments and Arab states and the Arab Monetary Fund, rather than Western banks, again, the man was marked for death. The Central Bank of Sudan was created by the Federal Reserve when the country became independent in 1964. It was nationalized in 1970. It was brought under Sharia law in 1984, and usury was forbidden. Barclays Bank was thrown out of the country for their refusal to accept this. Now, South Sudan is created by the West in 2011. Needless to say, its banking is controlled by, among other people, the Buffalo Bank, whose board of directors is apparently unknown. Now, there are few Buffalo in southern Sudan, so this is obviously a big New York bank. Now, the bank itself, the Central Bank of South Sudan, is run by Chairman Nir Nagur, who's educated in all places of Ireland, of all places, Abin Othro, who's educated in Italy and Canada, Odira Archon, who's educated with a master's in international banking from University of Loughborough in the UK. Loughborough, I think that's how you pronounce that. The point is that these people are all foreigners. Yeah, they're from Sudan, but they're Westerners. They're educated there. They speak the language. That's the bank's board of directors. The whole thing's a bait and switch. This is what the privatized economy will do. Western oil firms come in and pump the oil towards them. The Sudanese get very little for it. The bank is taken over by Western-trained Sudanese that have far more in common with people in the West than their own people, who they're, you know, really don't even mix with. And the common population gets absolutely nothing. Here's something else on Bashir's reign, written by the same person. Muriel Mirak Weisbach says, "The implications of Sudan's great leap forward are far-reaching and strategic. The country itself, fundamental revolution in thinking is taking place. Over the last 8 years, thanks to its oil revenues and the helping hand of China, Sudan has jump-started its economy. The impact on the political leadership, as well as the population more broadly, has been striking. Optimism has replaced pessimism, and a new spirit of self-confidence has taken hold. Leaders like former finance minister Hamdi, from the early 1990s, have been demoralized by the IMF and other pressures. He's now asserting a healthy, positive sense of aggressiveness, founded on the conviction that his country can make the progress it needs to make." Dr. Ghazi, a Dabani advisor to the president, told me in Khartoum that there are still problems, especially in ensuring that the benefits of growth are felt among the entire population, including the poorest. But the fundamental point is that contrary to all expectations, the IMF and the others, economic progress has been made by Sudan itself, which makes it all the more dangerous when others see what has been accomplished by the national will and with the help of China, India, and Malaysia, he stressed. That then sends a signal to others that they could break loose and develop. That statement is of immense power. The national will, connected with local sources of funding and national states that don't impose political or economic preconditions like the Chinese and the Russians. And he says that sends a signal to others that they could break loose and develop. Now, this is from an advisor to President Bashir. Break loose from what? Needless to say, you know, this is National Socialism in action. It exists everywhere. Every country can use it successfully. You know, had these countries developed as they were naturally developing, you know, Syria and Libya and Sudan, there would be no migrant crisis in Europe. There certainly wouldn't be piles of bodies here. They wouldn't be in Europe at all. They'd be in Africa building their own countries, building their own economies, as they should be doing. There's certainly nothing wrong with that. But the U.S., of course, brings people on war crimes as a displacement technique for its own crimes. Bashir's success, we just discussed, he's remained very popular in the country. The strategic location and strong leadership that he exemplified marked him for death. Bringing Russia and China closer to Africa as alternative sources of funding and political theory, and with the man said above, other African states, seeing Sudan's success, begins to follow suit. And if they do that, the U.S. then panics. They don't need the IMF. They don't need the World Bank. They don't need the dollar. They don't need American advisors. They don't need academics from Harvard. In fact, these people do tremendous damage wherever they go. Well, so what are the options that the West has, especially seeing how powerful and wealthy Sudan could be? You have mountains of gold and rivers of oil. Well, there's really only two things that they really have in their quiver, two arrows in their quiver that they could use anymore. The first, of course, is accusations of war crimes and human rights abuses, which can be anything. And even there, they're struggling to pin anything on Bashir. And number two, the creation and fomenting of civil wars, using different tribal groups who have a beef with the government or just plain old mercenaries. In some places like Sudan, I mean, Western sanctions on Sudan are meaningless. There's no trade with the U.S. And oftentimes, sanctions improve the position of the government. They only work on states like Venezuela that are very much dependent on the U.S. Sudan almost had no trade at all with the U.S. Economy. There was a time when the U.S. Treasury was trying to assist this thriving country. But the finance minister at the time, Hamdi, said that it was hurting the U.S. far more than Sudan. That these sanctions were absolutely meaningless. The Treasury Department years ago said that they were willing to assist. I don't know if they were assisting. I mean, Sudan was already doing very well, so long as certain conditions were met. And now this is a direct quote from the American Treasury. Well, actually, it's from Mirak Weisbach, but they're quoting the American Treasury Department. The Treasury Department in the U.S. was willing to assist with certain kinds of aid Sudan so long as conditions were met, and these are a weak state. Let me go back here. The exact quote is globalization, privatization, liberalization, and women's rights. These are the conditions that were directly attached to any assistance by the U.S. In other words, the U.S. demanded a typical liberal weak state that would then be putty in the hands of corporate capital. Botswana in Africa just decriminalized homosexual marriage. Like that's an issue anywhere. And in fact, the Trump administration threatened to cut off all aid and all FDI if Botswana didn't comply. So Weisbach says, the danger inherent in the unfolding crash is that hegemonic financial interests, desperate to maintain political clout, will unleash military aggression against those perceived as challenging the old dying order. And only Iran is targeted, but so is China, India, ultimately Russia. Attacks against Beijing for its cooperation with Sudan are on the increase, with absurd calls for the Chinese to use its influence in Sudan to solve the Darfur crisis. Furthermore, the hue and cry raised internationally against China's repression of the Tibetan uprising, which is fomented and nurtured by the West, is aimed at further isolating China. Now, of course, I've been saying this for many years. As the U.S. begins to fall to pieces, it will use its military to attack states that are breaking loose from the Fed's power, from the IMF's power. It will fail. The U.S. will be humiliated again, and so another method is going to have to be used if that's even remotely possible. Yeah, the U.S. may not have gotten necessarily what it wanted in all respects, but it destroyed the economy of a country that was moving forward very rapidly. Notice this, though, that Russia is still involved in South Sudan. The South Sudan organization government, which is a failed state in ways that even I couldn't conceive of, has still made deals with the CNPC, the National Petroleum Corporation of China, Malaysia's Petronas, India's Oil and Natural Gas Corporation, and Russian companies as well. All of this is the reason why the Darfur organization, this whole ridiculousness in Sudan, became an obsession – for Manhattan socialites and alienated academics. So the Civil War that broke out, that led to the Darfur crisis, of course, was about all of this. The border areas between the north and southern parts of the country are where huge oil fields are to be found. Since South Sudan has come into existence, many of the oil fields have been given over to the West, but not always. Which, again, is one of these things. The U.S. finances the creation of this country, and the government that comes to power gives over the oil fields to India and China. Now, many of them have been privatized and given over to the West. That's really how they're paying any debt that they have. But oil revenues make up about 70% of Sudan's export earnings and contribute to the development of the country. And unlike the South, though, which is entirely dependent on aid. So what happened when the U.S. created South Sudan, the Republic of South Sudan, in 2011? This is the world's newest independent country, and relies entirely on the U.S. and the West for any weapons and any aid and assistance. It has no functional economy anymore. Immediately upon coming into existence, the two main ethnic factions in South Sudan began slaughtering each other. And this is the democracy that they're talking about here. The civil war in all of Sudan then became the South Sudanese Civil War. It's between the forces of the government that the U.S. installed, President Kiir, and Riek Machar, who was his deputy at one time. In 2013, Kiir accused him of attempting a coup and starting a war. So then Machar then fled to lead a splinter of the opposition group that brought the government to power in the first place, the SPLM, and a faction that he created there. They immediately start shooting at each other. Ugandan troops immediately start coming in to assist the government, and the U.S. has very inefficient, ineffective peacekeepers in the country, too. There have been a bunch of truces. All of them have failed. And what Kiir did actually makes a lot of sense. In one of these peace treaties, he brought Machar back in as first vice president. I'm sorry. He replaced Machar as first vice president with a guy named Taban Dingai. That's an African name, not a Chinese name. It was designed to split the opposition. The dominant tribe there is the Dinka, which is about 40% of the population. And by bringing in one of their leaders into his government, he split the tribe in half. So far, about 500,000 people have been killed. And it's not like they have a bad economy. They have no economy at all. And of course, government's involved in atrocities. The rebels are. No one knows who's who. It's pure chaos. And with all this, some years ago, the former Secretary of State, John Kerry, was claiming credit for the independence of South Sudan. Like, this is something to be proud of. American firms did make a fortune in the country, but the U.S. was well aware the minute that country becomes independent and not under Bashir's control anymore, they're going to start slaughtering each other. Half the population has now become refugees in neighboring countries. That's 50% of the population. So you had a country that was doing very well, with gold that was found, oil that was swimming in, has now collapsed into fourth world status. Northern Sudan had no interest in harming anything in the southern part of the country where the oil was mostly found. Bashir was not unpopular in the south of the country because he built the economy up to a great extent. There had been peace in the south for some time. He was the only man seen as able to bring stability to the area, obviously as this ridiculous South Sudan Republic has proven. And no one was deluded enough to think that independence meant anything. The 99% figure was absolutely ridiculous. South Sudan has 64 tribes, the Dinka being the largest, and they control the government, or at least a faction of it controls the government. The Nuer is the second largest. And then you have nomadic groups that are fighting over grazing land and things like that. And some of these groups have never even reached even a modicum of civilized life, for better or for worse. But in 2010, a year before this country was created, Dennis Blair, the director of national intelligence, said, over the next 5 years, a new mass killing or genocide is most likely to occur in southern Sudan. That was a year before the West sponsored South Sudan's independence. In other words, they knew that independence of South Sudan and to separate them from Bashir's government in the north meant genocide and slaughter. So, this may be obscure to some people, but it isn't obscure in reality. These are the real issues that drive this world. You won't know about it by reading in newspapers. But this is why professional analysis is necessary. These places and these names and these governments may seem bizarre and obscure, but these are some of the most strategic areas on the planet. Simple ideology can't be simply imposed on everything. Democracy in a country that's, 50% of its population is starving and tribes are slaughtering each other. This is absolutely absurd. And now we know that the CIA was aware that the minute they create this independence thing, they're going to start slaughtering each other. To create enough chaos so that Western firms can go in there, steal as much as they possibly can, do all the asset stripping, the companies that the Chinese built, that Sudanese built, that the Northern Arabs built, that the Bashir government built over several decades, asset stripping and stealing it and bringing it back to the West for their own use. That's what happened. You should remember in 1998, the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical factory was destroyed in an American missile attack. They were humiliated. The Americans were humiliated. They destroyed the largest pharmaceutical factory in Sudan. It was exporting medicines to other parts of Africa. So they had to scramble. I remember this very well. They had to scramble and come up with some explanation. And they said, oh yes, they were making chemical weapons there, and we heard that Al-Qaeda is, invested. They knew that wasn't true when they were saying it, but they were embarrassed. They made a huge mistake. And typical of the arrogant and stupid American mentality, they won't take responsibility for it. They know that there's no way to prove that Al-Qaeda isn't running it. So they just said, their terrorists run it. And of course, that's exactly what the American press ran, and no one asked questions. There were a few leftists who began asking questions about this, but certainly nothing in the American press. Of course, the factory had no military purpose whatsoever. American claims, as always, were a complete fabrication. The factory was not accidentally destroyed, but medicines for parts of North Africa were incinerated by the American military fighting for freedom. And the purpose of it was done deliberately, and it was done to intimidate the Sudanese government and population. The point was, and we have enough WikiLeaks documentation on this, it was designed to terrorize the population into rejecting Bashir. That's terrorism in its most pure form. The German ambassador to Sudan, Werner Daum, calculated that the loss of the factory directly resulted in tens of thousands of deaths from malaria and tuberculosis because of the shortage in life-saving medicines. So when they accuse Bashir of genocide and war crimes and everything else, there is a psychological element to this. There is a sort of displacement where they're trying to deflect blame for what they know that they have done. So not only did the U.S. know that genocide was going to occur in the southern part of the country, they set the stage for it and had every university professor, every journalist, every one of these ridiculous African pseudo-intellectuals with the horn-rimmed glasses trying to sound, knowledgeable, talking about how wonderful the liberation of South Sudan was going to be. They were so dumb and so phony that they believed whatever they were told from the State Department, from Amnesty International, from British Petroleum, and all of the think tank front groups that they create. Remember, all of these NGOs, the Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, these are controlled by major corporations. Go onto any of their websites and look at their funding page. To maintain tax-exempt status in America, they have to show where the money comes from. And you go through pretty much a list of the elites of American capitalism. But even the guy who founded the Sudan People's Liberation Army, Jean Garang, he was trained at Fort Benning in Georgia. He was a captain in the Sudanese Army, he became a colonel. He became a colonel when he returned from Fort Benning. And he took a 4-year academic leave of absence. He got a master's degree in agricultural economics from Iowa State. And I think he got a PhD in economics from Iowa State too. So by 83, that was in 81, by 83, Garang was one of the instructors at the Sudanese Military Academy. And then at some point, with CIA money, because he was already essentially a Western American. You know, I mean, he was fluent in English. He had adopted American customs. It's typical. The guy was a foreigner. So the so-called Darfur genocide is what happened when the Sudanese Liberation Movement and the JEM, the largest rebel group in Darfur, entered Al-Fashtir, the capital city of North Darfur, and attacked the military, the garrison, the police, who were mostly sleeping at the time, and slaughtered them. The air base there, the planes were destroyed on the ground. Knowing full well that the resources that they destroyed, the chaos that they had unleashed, would mean that the country was now prostrate. This Jung Garang, who controlled this movement, was obviously CIA. He trained at Fort Benning, special warfare tactics elsewhere, as a PhD in economics from Iowa State in agricultural economics. So the United to Stop Genocide movement, you know, had corporate backing with almost $700 billion and a network of idiot university students around the world, about 200,000 activists in Western countries. That's what's happening here. The significance here is of immense importance. Now is gone after April. An extremely strong, what was it, a National Socialist in politics, clearly. I didn't have a chance. He gave a speech to the UN where 2006, where he said, you know, we seek real organic democracy in Sudan, not the Western imposed version. He said the debt burden on Sudan and other places, and he's really not even talking about Sudan, he's talking about elsewhere, because his debt was largely paid off. He said it places Western banks in a position of the colonizing power. He came out to the UN and said, I demand the cancellation of these debts so the African states can begin self-financing the rehabilitation of its economies. In other words, he doesn't want Western help. Western aid isn't really about assistance. It's about control. It's about creating an infrastructure so that a third world then is completely dependent on the first for manufactured goods and credit and even education and training. It's a tool for political control. You notice aid never seems to work. You know, Nigeria is swimming in oil. But foreign control warfare, foreign control in general, have destroyed these pipelines. Shell has completely given up trying to defend these pipelines. Most of their pipelines have been destroyed. A lot of this comes from other oil companies. But every tribal battle, every one of these battles controlled either by the CIA or another intelligence fact, or simply just local warlords, there can't be any development in this kind of environment. And Sudan Bashir is the one who's wanted for war crimes. And even there, they can't even get him for war crimes. They have him as an indirect participant. As always, the protests in Khartoum, somehow blaming the government for economic problems, which obviously come from the war in the south, all are upper-class students. These Jacobins are often Western-educated. They're educated by the NGOs. They're connected with these NGOs. Their protest signs are all in English. They associate more with Western politics than local. And you know, General Bashir's father was what they call a cow milker. He's from the very lower class. It's like a lot of these guys, he saw the army as a way to promote, you know, to get better and better, to improve himself economically. You know, in 2019, just before he was overthrown, Bashir said, we've dissolved the executive organ and formed a new government to carry out special tasks, declared a state of emergency to rebuild this economy into the violence, of course, that the West has created. The last thing I'm going to leave you with, the irony that really is sickening. There's an NGO out there called the World Food Program. It's connected to the UN. It's underwritten by MasterCard, American Express, and the U.S. government. Prior to the war that the West started, Sudan, and by the way, this World Food Program is heavily operational in Sudan, the massive, you know, starvation that's occurred. Up until very recently, Sudan, under Bashir, was the 77th largest donor to the World Food Program. And no one can see the irony there. Sudan's government was the 77th largest donor to this very organization that now has to feed most of Sudan and prevent complete and total mass starvation. Well, without Bashir there, the money that UAE and Saudi Arabia has promised is in abeyance. The wealth of the South has been expropriated. The independence, of course, was not only a farce, but a genocidal farce. The country's run by foreigners. The central bank is run by Sudanese who were all of it educated in the West. The whole thing is just a colonial proxy. So South Sudan, of course, has already seen its oil industry collapse. And the world, of course, is distracted by the war crimes of General Bashir, the man who was able to actually bring this together and create a great degree of prosperity. And the lies about that man is a way to displace and project the guilty conscience of the West. The genocide is strictly, not just in the West, but in Republican form of government, in liberalism, in capitalism, in this international postmodern variety. This is a genocidal system. And it's men like General Bashir, the ideology of nationalism, state militarized socialism, targeted investment, import substitution, that kind of thing. That was the only salvation that that country and most countries today have. And to soothe their conscience, the West pretends that he was the war criminal. Thank you, everybody. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.